Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Get Real with Rick Dancer. We love having you here. It's a great night. We're into September already, and fall's just around the corner. Didn't that feel like summer just kind of disappeared on us? I mean, yes, I'm in Montana, so that's a whole different thing. What we get is like 3 days of fall and then snow. And Kathy and I are sort of looking forward to snow, but kind of not too, because we had a hard winter last year. So we're hoping this one's not quite as bad. I don't mind the snow. Just go away. Our show is sponsored. We got a great show for you tonight. A guy I used to know in Eugene. Well, I still know him, but used to know him better than I do now. I looked on his page one day on social media, had the most profound things to write about. And I thought, gosh, Mark would make a great podcast. And so I just sent him a message and he said, I would love to. So you're going to hear his story. It's like all of our stories in many ways. It's full of tragedy and loss and love and bewilderment and wonders and magic. But you don't get magic without bewilderment, and you don't get love without loss. And you're going to love this. I think you're going to really enjoy it. So our sponsors tonight are BS Free MD. Tim and May have a podcast. They put out new content every single week. Focus on a lot of medical issues. They're doctors out of Sweet Home in Lebanon. And they put out great content. And you're going to really enjoy it because they really know what they're talking about. They're awesome people, and we love having them on board. Also, Chris Dental Family Dentistry, where everyone is welcome. Dr. Bratlin is a big believer in freedom. He's a big believer in people, and he's a big believer in your choice to do what you want to with your body. And he wants to take care of your teeth, and if you need dentures, they also have all the capability to do that as well. And our other sponsor tonight, right here in Montana, Montana Oral Surgery and Dental Implant Center. They do implants, and we have a video online on our YouTube channel that shows you how that happens. It's pretty phenomenal. My dad had double false teeth. His whole mouth was false teeth, and it was a big pain in his butt his whole life. With these, they're permanent. It's pretty profound what they can do. They're right here in Helena, Montana. And our other sponsor tonight, Greg Henkel, former Oregonian, former Washingtonian, now he's a Montanan, and he's a mortgage lender. And Greg can help you. If you're moving from Oregon to Montana or vice versa, you got to know how the systems work, and he understands all that. He can really help you, and they have programs for first-time buyers now where you can get that interest rate way, way, way down. So it's Greg Henkel. He's a great guy. You're going to love him. All right, so let's just get right to the chase. This is Mark Molino. And Mark, you wrote something on Facebook the other day. What I'm going to have you do before you do that, though, give people a little of your history, because you've had quite the careers.
Yeah.
And I love that about you, because you have a great depth and a breadth of experience in different things. Tell people what you've done.
Well, I would like to say, first of all, my last name is Molina.
Did I say it wrong?
You did. That's okay.
Thank you for correcting me. It's okay. You should correct me. I like that.
And I'd like to say that the owners of Fairway Mortgage, before they moved to Montana, helped us refinance our home before leaving for Montana. They did a great job.
Oh, awesome. Good. Well, thanks, Mark. So tell folks about you.
Sure. I first met Rick when I exited military service about 1995, 96. He was working out at Better Bodies in Thurston. And I know it's about me, but I just want to say with respect to you as a human being, Rick, ever since I've met you, you've always been approachable. You've always been kind. You've always treated people with respect, and you've treated everyone as equals. And that's one of the things I've never forgotten about you as a person. And I just wanted to draw a remembrance to that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I know we're both God-fearing men, and you know, I believe God has a plan. Jeremiah 29:11 is true today as it was back then. He has a plan for us of peace and hope and prosperity. The hard part is the next part of that verse always goes, not of your undoing. Right. And I tend to undo a lot of things, good things that he has planned for me. So, but I appreciate you recognizing the good things.
Yes, sir. Well, let me start off with the post, if I may. Let's go back to that post.
Okay.
I've been meeting with a lot of folks as of late, and they've been struggling with the challenges, you know, post-pandemic, whatever that means to everyone who's listening. A lot of people still feel like they're in an existential crisis of some sort. They haven't got their rhythm back. Finances are unstable for whatever reason, without judgment, trying to re-navigate life as it has, as we re-emerge from what has, you know, befallen us. And so I wanted to make a post about reminding people what they have been through. And I said, what are the five of the most difficult days you've ever had, the hardest days of your life? And if you can write those down and articulate those and remember those, irrespective of what you're facing right now, you've already survived the worst days of your life.
Because we forget that, don't we, Mark? We get caught up on, and what's so dumb is like some of the things are so little. I was supposed to get those phone calls done and this, and then we go home and we don't sleep because we didn't get everything on our checklist done. When you realize that that's really pretty small compared to what you've already had the strength to build and go through.
Yeah, and I think that the advent of social media has created this hyper awareness of what others might be doing better than you or how life might appear to be more significant than yours. And so we lose our way. And so we have a tendency to think that we're less than or in some way we're failing or we haven't arrived where we had hoped we would be.
So tell them your five. Start with number one.
Number one I started with was the death of my father when I was 7. He was 39. He had retired from the military at 38. He was a Korean War veteran, Vietnam War veteran. He had been retired about a year and a half. And him and my mother were both Depression era children. And so they grew up, you know, in the time of World War II without indoor plumbing, all of those things, you know, the segregation in America, the cultural struggles of the day.
Right.
And so they had a unique perspective on perseverance. And so he died at 38. He had a heart attack at home and then he had a stroke. But let me go back to say this was 1971. So the viewers that will hear this, I'm 59 years old now. So medicine wasn't in 1971 what it is today.
Right.
So they kept the doctors, the military doctors kept telling them it was just indigestion and kept telling him to take Rolaids.
Oh.
When it was really his heart.
Right.
And so until he had a massive heart attack at home, nobody knew and it was too late. Wow. So he had a stroke and this was in 71. So for your listeners, again, I'm going to say some things that may seem foreign to many of them. But when I was a child, children were not allowed in hospital rooms because they were considered to interfere with healing. Huh. So we never got to visit our father while he was in the hospital.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So around it was in December 71 when he passed, December 19th to be exact. A couple of days before that, our mother put, there were 7 children. I'm the youngest of 7. And so she put us all in our Christmas sweaters, got us all dressed up to look like Christmas, took us to Randolph Brooks Air Force Base. And we stood at the bottom of the hospital and she walked our father. She was on his right side because his right side had quit working from the stroke a week after he had his heart attack. So she walked him to the window and we were able to look up and we're all able to wave. We got all excited. There's daddy. And that was as close as we could get to him. And then a couple of days later, he was going to be released to come home. But he got up to go, according to his roommate, he got up to go to the bathroom and he must have forgot that his right side was paralyzed. And he tried to stand up. And, you know, back then the military hospitals were all concrete. So he slipped and hit his head on the concrete floor and went into a coma. And he died a couple of days later.
So you never saw him again.
Never saw him again. Never had the chance to feel his touch, hear his voice, any of
that. What does that do to a kid that age? How did that affect you, like in your life?
Well, yeah. So interesting. This is important because this came up for me in the isolation of the pandemic. All of a sudden, I started having all these profound memories of, I knew something was going on in my brain and I didn't know what it was. These memories were resurfacing of seeing my father over and over and over and seeing him wave and us waving to him, but not seeing him again until he was in his casket. And seeing all the people around him, my grandfather, grandmother, his brothers, the extended family. And then, and this was, of course, 1971. So in 1971, Rick, another interesting fact is children had to be 9 years old to go to a military funeral where there was full military honors.
Really?
Yeah. So my father, because he was a Korean War veteran, Vietnam War veteran, had full military honors. And my twin brother and I were not allowed to go. So we had to stay home. So one minute he's in his suit in the casket. I remember my mother telling us to go kiss him to say goodbye. And they close the casket. We go to the church to have, you know, we're Catholic at the time and had our mass. And then that was it. I never got to see him again. I never got to say goodbye, see the goodbye until I went to the funeral, graveyard with our mother to see his white headstone. And so this was, again, 1971. And there was no talk about depression. There was no
PTSD.
Any of those things. So our mother, when our father died, she sat us all down. There were seven kids. She sat everybody down in the living room. When my father died, my mother was 37 with seven minor children.
Wow.
She didn't have an education. She couldn't drive. She had stayed home taking care of us and said to us, "Your father's gone now. And I know you're used to having me at home. But I have to go to work because this family is not going on food stamps. We are not going on welfare. We are going to work and earn the money for everything that we need." And she started pointing to my older siblings. She said, "You're going to work. You're going to work. You're going to work." And that was a profound moment for me.
Why?
Because we learned from her example that you don't have to lay down in the face of death. And my older brothers, they were already ranch hands and they had to get other jobs. You know, minimum wage at that time was $1.95 an hour.
Wow.
So everybody was working that could work. My brothers that were 14, when he turned 14, and my other sister, when they went to work, because in Texas, you could work at 14 at that time.
Okay.
Yeah. I started working at 14, making $2 an hour cleaning bathrooms.
So, and I think like what a lot of people wouldn't understand about that, not going in that, growing up that situation, is like when I went to work in the berry fields at 13, that was my school clothes money. That was for me. You were making money that you're giving so that you guys can have food,
yes,
and pay your rent,
yes,
and, or mortgage or whatever. You know what I mean? It wasn't like you're working for yourself. You're working for your family.
Correct. Now, my father, he got his high school diploma or his equivalency GED in his last tour of service in Alaska before he retired. That's how important it was to him to try to get an education. Because him and my mother were the oldest in their families. They didn't get to go to high school. They had to work the fields to help provide.
Right.
So my father was able to get his high school diploma while he was active duty military. And that meant a lot to him.
I bet.
And so when he died, he had enough foreknowledge. He had a will. He had insurances, so the house was paid off. We had an acre that was paid off, left money for my mother to do the things that they had talked about doing. And so that transition from life to death for our family was easier because my father had done his due diligence.
Right.
And
so go back to the pandemic. So the pandemic comes along, people are in lockdown. You can't see relatives that are in the hospital, all that stuff that starts bringing that back for you. Even if it wasn't happening in your own world. That's what was happening in the world.
Yes.
And what did that look like for you?
Well, as you said, it was all over social media. People couldn't see their family members waving from windows, you know, walking by graduations and stuff. And all of a sudden, these memories started coming back. I would hyperventilate. I couldn't sleep.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah, because when my grandfather died, it was my father's father. It was the same thing. He was really sick. He had a heart attack. We went to the hospital, and all we could do was pull ourselves up on the edge of the window to wave to him, you know, and all excited to see him as well as crying at the same time, because we know he's must going to die like daddy just died.
Right. What does it mean to not be able to say goodbye?
Oh, it means everything. At 20, I think I was 28, 29. I was at Fort Lewis. I was in 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. I was in long range reconnaissance, and I had been severely injured and medevac for the second time. They put me in a desk job, but a classified desk job. But I was supposed to deploy with my unit to Joint Readiness Training Center for Chaffee, Arkansas, to be official opposing forces for the U.S. Army Training Regiment.
Wow.
And so, but because I was injured, my entire unit left and I couldn't go because of my injury. And so I was considered non-deployable because I had the injuries were that severe. And so that began this process of feeling this intense grief and loss. And as I was struggling with severe depression at that time, I went to my immediate supervisor to share with him what I was going through. And I was warned at that moment in time, if you talk about this anymore, we're going to take away your security clearance.
Wow.
And put you in a position where you don't have contact with anything or anyone. There's consequences for talking about this kind of thing, Sergeant Molina.
So you had to stuff it back down inside again.
Right. Because the military does not want to hear about your mental health issues. They say they do, but I assure you they don't.
No, I've heard that from many, 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 many people.
And so I had to, as that stuff was surfacing in my life coming up, because just because you're bearing emotion doesn't mean it's dead.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's usually more alive than ever.
Right. And so I had to stuff it back down. So, you know, the pandemic was triggering all these memories. And then, you know, I remember asking my mother, sitting in the room with her, she would cry a lot, but only when she was alone. She never cried in front of the children as a whole.
Right.
And I would sit with her and she would cry and I would hold her hand and give her Kleenexes. And she would say how much she missed our dad, how hard it was. She was scared all the time. Didn't know what to do, trying to make sure there was enough money to pay the bills and feed the kids. And I asked her one day, I said, you know, mommy, what did you say to daddy when he died? Because she was able to get to Randolph Brooks Air Force Base. He was already passed, but she got to sit with him with the body and hold his hand while it was still warm.
Right.
And she said, I thanked him for being a good husband, for being a good father, and how much I knew that he loved me and how much I loved him. And I promised him that I would take care of all of you and that I wouldn't let anything happen to you, but that I would always love him for being a good man for this family.
Wow.
And then, as you saw in the post, my mother drowned and she was.
So 40. That's number two.
That's number two.
And she, how old was she when she drowned?
She was 40.
Texas. So that was just a few years later?
3 years later.
So now you've got 7 kids who don't have a mom or a dad.
Correct. And Texas, wow. Texas is known for their flash flooding, the severity of flash flooding. So it was a thunderstorm, severe thunderstorm, and her and my aunt were trying to get home from where they were. And they were just caught up in it. They got off the highway because they couldn't probably see and got on a side road to be safe. And in Texas, there's what are called low water crossings. And they have these sticks that say 4 feet, 5, 6, 8 feet, 10 feet. That's how low they go. So you can see the stage of the water.
Okay.
So because it was raining so hard, they probably didn't see that it was at flood stage. And there was a lot of people parked on the bridge above it waiting out the storm. And they saw my mother, my aunt was with her too. They were together. and they entered just driving along, not too fast, but entered in, and then the entered the water and it began to take the car away, and it washed the car up a little bit. And I know these things because of the witnesses that explained it to the newspapers.
Right.
It was a very, as my father was retired military, he was a volunteer. You see me volunteering all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, I learned that from my mother and my father. They volunteered everywhere in the community. So they modeled that.
So Mark, how old are you at that point in your life when your mom's now gone?
I was 10.
So who takes, what happens to you kids? Like all seven of you, like.
Well, by this time there was four of us that were minors and the other three were now adults.
So who took care of you?
Well, we lived with one family for a while, then we lived with another family for a while.
How do you explain to a seven-year-old that your mom drowned, or a 10-year-old?
Sure, sure. So my twin brother and I, we went to bed that night. And I'm going to share this dream with, as bizarre or unreal as it may sound to some of your viewers. I think that it will resonate with those that share the common faith that we share.
Okay.
But my twin brother and I, I had a dream, and I saw this angel in the dream, big, beautiful angel, tall, white garments. And he said to me, "Your mother has drowned, but do not be afraid. I will be with you, watching over you all the days of your life." And I woke up, not afraid, but understanding that something supernatural and divine had just happened. And I sat up real quick, and my twin brother Michael sat up at the same time. And I looked at him and I said, by the look on his face, I said, "Did you have the dream that I just had?" And he looked at me and said, "Did you have the dream that I just had?" And we shared the dream. It was the exact same dream, the exact same angel, the exact same wording. And as soon as we shared that together, we heard our sisters screaming in the kitchen. And my oldest brother was there, and he was on the phone. And he said, "They think she drowned," is what we heard. And then my sister started screaming. And so then we were listening to the phone call that they were trying to find the bodies of my mother and my aunt.
And so you lost your mother and your aunt at the same time. So you have all your cousins struggling with the same thing.
Yes.
Oh my God, Mark, that's just awful.
Yeah. You know, and because it was, my mother was a community volunteer, it was all over the newspapers. It was on TV, it was on the radio. And so they found my aunt's body almost right away, but not my mother's. It took several days before they found it. I mean, I can tell you what I read, how they found it floating in the, stuck in barbed wires and trees and bloated and bruised. I mean, I still remember all of that. It was in the paper. They were very descriptive of the paper.
Yeah, just what a family needs to hear.
Yeah, and so you're following this, you're waiting for your mother to be found.
And hoping that she's alive.
And hoping that she's alive. Yeah. And it's on the radio, it's on the TV, and it's in the newspaper every single day. Mrs. Romana Castillo still has not been found. Her body has not yet been recovered. Searchers are still looking. And you're this child, and your world is spinning because your mother walked out the door and you never saw her again.
Right. So there's a second one you didn't get to say goodbye to.
The second one you didn't get to say goodbye to. And so this was 1974, right before Thanksgiving. So my father died right before Christmas in 71. My mother drowns at Thanksgiving time. And so that made the holidays hard, first of all, from then on.
Well, for sure. I remember my wife's grandfather died, or his parents died together, I guess, some tragic accident around Christmas time. And her grandpa didn't like Christmas at all. It was like, I don't want to do it, because it brought up all those memories. Mark, what was number three?
Number three was, I had a child when I was in the active duty U.S. Army. He was born with some neurological issues. I was at 10th Mountain Division, Fort Drum, New York. And 10th Mountain Division, the U.S. Army signed a contract with a local hospital up there in Watertown, New York, what they call Snowtown, USA. It was a small local hospital. They agreed not to build an Army hospital so that they could help build the economy of Watertown. Unfortunately, that meant that that smaller hospital in Watertown didn't have any advanced medical surgeons, facilities, things of that nature. So when he was born, we were having to drive. He was born at Syracuse University, obviously in Syracuse. So from Watertown to Syracuse was 124 miles one way.
Wow.
So I'd have to get up and drive 124 miles to take him to the doctor and then 124 miles home. So that was several times a week. And then his medical condition advanced so significantly in the negative that they ended up medevacing him to Walter Reed Medical Center. And so once they got him stabilized enough, they sent us back to Fort Sam Houston only so that we could be sent to to Watertown, 10th Mountain Division, so we could they could medevac him to Fort Sam Houston.
And this is as a baby then?
This is as a baby. In the military, they have what's called compassionate reassignment. So if you have a sick spouse or child, there's a couple of places that they'll allow you to go to choose from for whatever reason. So there was three hospitals that could take care of my son: Madigan of Fort Lewis, Washington, the hospital of Fort Carson, Colorado, or Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. And since I'm from Texas, I requested Fort Sam Houston so I could be close to family.
Right. So what happened to this boy?
Well, he ended up dying right before he turned one.
And what was his name?
His name was Jared Isaiah.
Jared Isaiah.
Jared Isaiah.
Oh, look at him.
And that is the last time he ever smiled in the medical center and the Army where we were in Fort Sam Houston. And then he died a couple of days later. We were very fortunate that we had that camera and we were able to snap that final photo of him. I've always been very thankful for that.
I bet. Yes. So then what goes next?
Well, you know, before his death, there's things you come to conclusions on.
What's that?
Number one, you have to, the doctors say he's at a point now where medical science can't really help him anymore. We have to let nature take its course. So as nature takes its course, do you want us to resuscitate him if he dies, right? So if anything should happen. And so he had suffered enough at that point. We came to that conclusion that if medical science had done what it could do and God wasn't going to do anything different, you know, death is part of life. I learned young.
This is a plan.
Yeah. It's
whether we like it or not. Yeah.
Correct. And so signing that do not resuscitate order, it's a very impactful challenge for a parent because you're saying that it's no longer in my hands. My faith isn't enough. Medical science isn't enough. We've done all we can do. But it's this love, this mercy you have for your child that you want the suffering to stop.
Yeah.
You just really, more than anything, you just want them to not be in any more pain. And so he ends up, you know, passing away and they still call you. Are you sure? They ask you, are you sure? Do you don't want us to do anything?
Right.
And we have to reaffirm
right.
That.
Because no, I'm not sure, but this is the best answer I have right now. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? That would be so hard mm-hmm. because you want that person in your life, but you also don't want them to suffer. It's kind of like, oh God, that would just be hell.
You know, we got to stay with him. They let us stay with him for a little bit. I call some of my family and from New Braunfels, from the hospital was about 30 minutes and several of them came to support us at that time and were able to, you know, touch him one last time. And it was tough. It was tough to let them take his body. It was tough when the coroner came. It was tough when they said, it's time for him to go now. We have to take him.
Right.
You have to let them do that. And then, of course, comes driving to my hometown. It was about 30 minutes away. One of my cousins is a mortician there, and he arranged where he got us a free spot in at the graveyard where my parents and my grandparents are buried. And one of my uncles purchased the headstone, and another uncle purchased the coffin. And my cousin got the plot donated. So we were able to bury him where my parents are buried. And that helped a lot of that. But, you know, part of this letting go and surviving is, you know, driving from Fort Sam Houston to my hometown, I had to pull over on the highway because I was shaking so much and crying so hard to have to make those funeral arrangements. I couldn't do it, you know. So I couldn't do it. I had to stop at one of my uncle's house and have him drive me over there because I couldn't barely walk by myself.
Right. So did you, was on the list picking out your son's coffin?
Yeah. So picking out his coffin, picking out the last set of clothes that he's ever going to wear. And because of his issues, his neurological issues, we allowed them to do an autopsy because they wanted to take some samples of his brain because they felt like they could help other children with his issues. So it had to be a closed casket due to the autopsy.
Right.
Right. So the challenging part was when the day of the memorial, his memorial service at the funeral home, I'm there by myself to sign a bunch of paperwork and stuff. And they bring my son in his casket. And the funeral director says, oh, I got to go do something. I'll be right back. And I'm in this room by myself with a casket with my child that just died. And my whole body was, I felt like I was hemorrhaging internally. And I wanted to take the casket lid off and pull him out.
Right.
And say, you know, you can't have him yet.
Right.
It's too early. It's too soon. He doesn't belong to you yet. He still belongs to me. And my I was trembling and shaking and sweating and crying. And you know, I got the funeral director came back in and I said, please don't ever do that again. I don't have the strength to be left in this room by myself and my child and in this casket.
Right.
Don't do this again. And he was like, oh my God. He said, oh my God, I'm sorry. I wasn't even thinking. My apologies, Mr. Moore.
Yeah. So Mark, what's number five?
Well, that was my father, my mother, my father, my son, and then picking out his headstone and picking out.
There we go.
The clothes. So.
So what in your life, what have you learned about all this? Because the struggles didn't end.
No, the struggles don't end. I think for me, Rick, how I learned to endure was really my mother's example. I mean, she made sure to fight through the pain, to stand tall in the face of it all, to not give up, to not quit, to see her share her gratitude about being able to get to the hospital to hold my father's hand while it was still warm.
Right.
And to have that conversation with him. That showed me more about how we're able to endure suffering. And there should be a measure of gratitude for me that you've been trusted with this this moment in time to model something beyond yourself. That's how I get through it.
So how do you keep from becoming angry, or do you?
Well, anger is part of grief. So the grief cycle is the grief cycle. We're not immune from it. We're not immune from those terrible feelings, the despair, the isolation, the loneliness. Yes, you get angry. Why didn't I make a different decision? Whatever that may have been. But I think for me, I was always able to think back towards my mother and look how she survived, how well she did it. And I always felt like if my mother could bear up under so much pressure and stress, remember, she didn't even know how to drive when my dad died. She had to learn how to drive. She had to learn how to do all this stuff.
Go ahead.
If she could do it, I could do it.
Don't you think that's the interesting thing about the past too, is my grandma was like that. Her husband died in a hunting accident when my mom was 11. She had three kids, all 11 and under. She took those kids, went to Monmouth, lived in basically a chicken coop, put herself through college at Monmouth, became a teacher, and she raised my mom and those two kids. She never remarried. She raised them all by herself. And then people I remember used to say, your grandma's kind of a bitch. She's kind of angry and mean. And I never saw that. I always saw this woman who just, who fought for everything. And, you know, and that example, I think, is pretty powerful. And I think sometimes we don't understand how many men died in wars and things like that when they couldn't save him. Because the only reason he died is the guy with him didn't know how to put a tourniquet on. And he bled to death. He shouldn't have died. It was just a shot in the arm. And he shouldn't have died. But then they persevere and go through that. And I don't think women like that get enough credit for what they, and look at what she did to you with you. I mean, it left an indelible mark on your life, Mark. That's kind of a funny way. And to this day, I'm sure you just love her to death. And she's like that object of unconditional love for you, like my grandma was for me. It was like, you know, that's how it is. So how many kids do you have now?
Well, I have three older ones over 30, right? They're married. They have their own lives now. And then I have an 11-year-old. I remarried 19 years ago, and I have an 11-year-old daughter, 59 with an 11-year-old.
So, you know what, Mark? Hey, it keeps you young or something, right? Yeah. At least your hair's not gray yet.
You know, gray, you're graying, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, look at me, but I'm a little older than you. So what do you know about God?
Well, I know that he's faithful. He's ever present. He helps us through the storm. He helps us through the valley of the shadow of death. I've never not been aware of his eyes upon me, even in the dark days, even when I struggled with drug and alcohol addiction as a young man, from all the pain, everything that was stuck inside of me.
Right.
When I was in the army and all that stuff of, it was surfacing and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't even know what it was. And for your listeners, you know, I would say that if you going through something very traumatic and very traumatic loss, find ways to cope with it because it's going to surface.
Right.
You can't run from it.
Did you ever do therapy?
Well, for me, what happened was I came up positive on a urinalysis when I was in the army. When I was in Germany.
Oh, you got forced therapy?
Well, it was exactly what I needed when I came up positive on a urinalysis. And in the military, that's automatic drug and alcohol. You're either thrown out or you're allowed to go to rehab. One of the two. And so I wasn't thrown out. I was allowed to go to rehab. The other guys that got busted on the urinalysis, they were forced out. I was the only one not forced out. And why, I don't know.
So how has that helped you in your life today?
Well, when I went to therapy, there was a DOD, Department of Defense, contractor. She was a lady out of Georgia. And she asked me about my life. And I shared with her for the very first time at 22 years old, 23 years old, I shared with her my entire life, my youth, my parents' death, all of that. And I felt like I talked for 2 hours straight. And she was crying and crying and crying. And when I was done, she said, she had a big gap in her teeth, right? This beautiful Southern accent, beautiful Southern smile. And she said, I'm going to mimic her a little bit. She says, Mark, you don't have a drug problem, honey. You have an emotional problem.
Huh.
And as soon as she said that, Rick, that black cloud that I felt had been following me since my youth, in that moment, dissipated.
See, don't you think that because we hide stuff and don't deal with it, you know, I mean, I went that in my 30s, went to therapy and, you know, over issues in my life, and it was controlling me. And, you know, and until somebody sees that this is, you know, everybody has shit. You know, we all have it, and you just have to let people be who they are and get the help. And I think therapy is the best thing that ever worked for me. I mean, it got me through some, you know, I still should probably be going. There's still stuff, you know. I noticed the other day when, for me, you know, my PTSD, and I don't mean, but I said that jokingly online. I said, well, it's not like this is really, because I think PTSD should be for people that have gone through extreme trauma. And I said, but you know, for me, COVID, when I started seeing numbers going and people start whispering about the thing again. My wife and I looked at each other and we were so angry. We were like, no, I am not doing that. And it was like, and this person said, no, that's PTSD. And I went, you know, I think we've all have to give each other a break for the last 3 years. We've been through a lot. It's brought up a lot that we may not, you, because you're kind of more in touch with yourself. You get it. You can put the number, you know, the dots together. But think of all those people out there who don't have that skill, not because they're stupid, just because they've never had to do that. Which is why I think your question is going back to the beginning is so perfect for people to sit down with them and whatever you believe, if it's your God, if it's whatever, just yourself, sit down and write the five hardest moments of your life. And they don't have to be a death necessarily. They can be a firing or an embarrassment or something, you know, and you're putting that all down. And then see how that's made you into the person that you are today. It's a super valuable skill.
You know, life is not fair, and we have to accept that, and we have to be okay with that. And I think for me, our mother used to tell us all the time, because you know they grew up in an age before, not every generation, and I like to say this for your younger listeners, grew up with the options of unemployment and food stamps and all of those things.
Right.
So that generation of my parents and before them, literally, if you did not work, you did not eat.
Right. There was no backup plan.
There was no backup plan, and you had to have a will to survive.
I remember when my dad was, college graduate from Linfield in education, and then to make ends meet because he had four kids, he taught full time during the day, and then at night and on the weekends, he worked at a shoe store and sold shoes. And that wasn't unusual. It wasn't like, oh, I think people today would go, you know, look at that kind of funny. In Montana, I've noticed a lot of people have two jobs. It's pretty common to make ends meet because the cost of people, it's not pay, the pay isn't as good as in Oregon. So a lot of people do that. So do this to wrap this up. What's your best piece of advice to people? Just whatever the first thing that comes to your head, because this has been a really super interesting conversation, Mark, and I really appreciate you, kind of exposing your life like that. And I think it's, I think this is how we learn through story. You know, the stories of people's lives is how people, because there's going to be somebody out there who says, well, I have worse than that. And there's going to be somebody who says, oh, I've never been through. But whatever yours, whatever ours is, it's the worst thing that could happen to us because it happened to us. You know what I mean? So what would you say to somebody if I'm sitting in your office and I'm just saying, Mark, what's your best piece of advice for me?
Life is seasonal. Nothing lasts forever. Not the good or the bad. Things will come through that we have to experience. Things will come through that we have to accept. Things will come through that we have to learn from. Things will come to us that we're either forced to carry or forced to set down. And to allow that season to be what it is and know that this too shall pass.
Right. And I think guilt is a real, and shame are real things that really keep us from, because we could be ashamed of our addictions or ashamed of our mental health status or ashamed of, yeah, I'm not strong enough to not have PTSD, but that's just not true. And I think what I love what's going on in this, there's a lot of things in this country I don't like right now. But one thing I really, really, two things I like. One, we're being forced to stop being apathetic and participate in our communities, our lives, our elections. We can no longer just go, I don't want to do any of that, because we're seeing where that gets us. And I think that gives us the up. And I think the other thing is we're being forced to deal with fear. Mm-hmm. It's like, how much are you going to use fear to educate you, or how much are you going to use fear to run you? And you know, I remember during the pandemic, there was this great moment when I was reading something out of the Bible, and it said, and I've used this verse for years anyway, but fret not, for fretting brings on more evil. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is so true. The more I worry, the more evil. It's almost like you're standing at a door and saying, come on, all you little demons, get in here. You know, everything bad that could happen, come on in and join me. And instead saying, I can do what I can do about this, and then I got to let it go. And I think that's a good lesson. And I think your life says that to me.
Well, I appreciate that. I just, we're all going to go through hard times for any number of reasons. It's okay to acknowledge that it's a hard time. It's okay to even verbalize if you're going through a hard time. I think social media has contributed to people's shame, as you say, embarrassment, as you say, because much of the things that we go through, I always tell people, whose business is it anyway?
Right.
So it's nobody's business. So move on.
My favorite line, some lady wrote me one day, Rick Dancer, it's none of your business how other people feel about you. And I went, you know what? That is profound. It's not, I don't like you because of this. Well, that's really not my business. So you can deal with that on your own. So Mark, thank you again so much for coming on and sharing your life. Thanks for just writing that on your Facebook page, because obviously that was a hint from God for me to call you and find out if I'd get you on here. And I appreciate your story and I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much for all you're doing to bring voice to important issues and to give others a chance to express themselves. That's important.
You're welcome. Mark, thanks again. See you later, man.
Good day, brother.
All right. So there you go. I think that's how, maybe it's just me. I don't know if you're like that or not. I learn through people's stories. And you go back and you listen to Mark and you're listening to those things, and I can bring things come up for me of moments that were hard. And they may not be as tragic as what Mark has, but it opens a door for me to be able to deal with myself. And I think the thing, my advice to you as a viewer, the thing not to do, don't feel sorry for Mark. He doesn't need to be felt sorry for. If the story touches you and makes you sad, then go into that for you. Like, dig into that. Why? Why does that? Well, because, no. Why does that make you sad? What's that bringing up for you? And then go deal with it. If the worst thing we can do is hear a story, hear something like that, and go, oh, that's sad, and then just go on like nothing ever happened and you live your life because you missed a great opportunity. So we should be taking every opportunity. You only get 70, 80, 90 years if you're lucky on this planet. Wouldn't you like to live them as peacefully as you can? I'm Rick Dancer. This is Get Real with Rick Dancer. Thanks for being with us. Share this on your page, because there's probably other people out there that need to hear it, would like to hear it, and would find peace if they heard it. I'll see you later.